thanks so much for joining Making Healthcare Work For You, Different Perspectives and Empowering Solutions. I'm Stephanie Fields, joined by my co-host, Dr. Apoorv Gupta, and today we are welcomed by Dr. Helen Reese, who is an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, founder and chief medical officer at Empathetics, author of The Empathy Effect, and she has a TED Talk that has over 800,000 views called The Power of Empathy, and she is featured in a PBS docuseries called Untold, A Brief History of the Future, and that is going to be airing on April 24th. So Helen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
It is clear that you are an incredibly busy woman who is very invested in the world of empathy and healthcare. So we really are excited to talk to you about this. And I think a good place to start is that you were telling us that the work that you do is really blending science with soft skills, which I thought was super cool because I don't know that I've ever heard it phrased that way. Where did your passion come from for both the psychiatry field and then empathy specifically, to the point that you realized that this was another way that you had to really focus your career to help change the future?
Well, I think the interest in psychiatry just goes back to a strong interest in how the brain works and philosophy, and also the fact that my parents came from a traumatized war experience in Europe. So that definitely brought a lot of empathy for what they went through. And I have a sibling with some mental health challenges. And so these experiences always influence us more than we even realize when we're making career choices. But my strong interest in empathy really started in my psychiatric training when I learned about the theories of self-psychology from Heinz Kohut, who believed that empathy was psychological oxygen, and without empathy, there would be no cure. And so this concept really stuck with me because it really created much more opportunity for patients to change when we empathized with them, rather than trying to use, you know, some traditional techniques that were more about interpretation and other types of more cognitive types of relating. And the deep interest in empathy research really started when a psychotherapy research group that I was part of, we started to notice that many of our patients in this research group were complaining about the care they were getting in their medical visits. And a research assistant said, "I think these people just need more empathy." And somebody else said, "Yeah, too bad you can't teach it." And just then I had started reading about the neuroscience of empathy and how we were finally able to see what brain regions were activated when we saw people suffering. And I took a really deep dive and I got a medical education fellowship to spend 2 years immersing myself in this literature. And I found that I believe there was a way to teach empathy and that we just hadn't had the visibility into the brain regions that we needed to activate in order to do that. So with that research and developing an empathy training tool, I got funding to do a randomized controlled trial of my brief training at Mass General Hospital in 6 different specialties. And my research group, the same group, we spun off and became the Empathy and Relational Science Program. And we had a team of about 6 researchers. We found that when randomizing doctors to either receiving empathy training or not, that patient ratings actually significantly improved with a really brief intervention. And I'm talking like 3 hours of training. So that got a lot of press. The New York Times picked it up because it happened around the same time when there were lots of headlines about dissatisfaction in healthcare. And so because of this robust attention, I realized like this is something that we don't just need locally. This is probably something we need globally. And a business person approached me and said, "I want to help you scale this because this is so desperately needed. And if you just stay in one place, it's only going to reach a few hundred people, but it needs to reach people broadly." And that was the founding of Empathetics about 12 years ago.
What a journey. Thank you, Helen, for taking us through that. It's really remarkable that it's so well grounded in scientific principles and research and, you know, and how much you've studied it. I think that really comes across. Maybe as we set out, Helen, one thing you and I and Stephanie have been discussing is this idea of what do we call this general area, these values of empathy? How do we distinguish them from compassion, which is obviously very closely related? That's another, you know, another concept that Stephanie and I talk about a lot. Love is another thing that we're talking about a lot, and generally other related emotions, feelings, values as well. So maybe you can help us just start off the conversation there in terms of how you define empathy versus some of the others.
That's a great question, because these terms are used interchangeably, and they're actually very related, I think, in a very purposeful way. Empathy is our capacity to perceive the emotions of others. So I think of it as the input. And so any physicians and nurses on your podcast, I think of it as the afferent arm. It's how we actually get the information that something is happening of importance to other people. And empathy is not just for pain and suffering. It's also like we feel joyful when we see people get a good test result or that their cancer is cured. So we empathize not just with negative emotions, but also with positive emotions. And our brain has this capacity that when we see pain and suffering, our own pain centers light up, which means that we are sharing that feeling temporarily. And why do we do this? Like, why should we be feeling the pain of others? Why has this trait endured through the millennia? It's because, first of all, it teaches us to avoid painful things. Like if we see somebody stepping on some glass, we learn quickly, like we shouldn't do that. But even more, when we see someone in pain, it activates motivating centers to act. And that action, once put into play, is compassion. So compassion is what we can observe and see people doing, right? So we see that it's a compassionate person because maybe they've touched that patient on the shoulder, squeezed their hand, or just given them a really concerned look. So compassion is the efferent arm of this empathy loop. So empathy is really there to motivate us to do something. And compassion feels so good because it's connected with reward centers called the nucleus accumbens. And it's the same reward center, believe it or not, that's activated by cocaine and other like stimulating drugs. So helping is a very rewarding and pleasant emotion. And I think that that's partly why this capacity has lasted throughout human development. It's because we wouldn't be here without the help and cooperation, empathic connection and compassion of others.
That's a really fascinating way to look at it that I don't know that we've talked about and broken down before, but I really love that, you know, one's the input and one is the actual act of it. And this may seem like a silly question, but does everybody, you said that the same, you can see the pain centers lighting up in people who are watching someone else in pain. Does that happen for everyone, or are there people who are inherently more impacted by that? And if so, are the people that you're working with, doctors, nurses, other people in the medical field who have gone into a field where they're helping, more susceptible to maybe self-protection too, that could lower the compassion that they have, but subsequently also make them more susceptible to receiving this training and realizing that this is an amazing feeling by helping people?
So to answer your first question, there is a spectrum of people who, I mean, you've probably heard of mirror neurons, these neurons that help us mirror what other people are feeling. There are actually many shared neural circuits. It's not just mirror neurons. People have more of these circuits, few. It's just like intelligence, music, or like talent for athletics. Our brains are all different. And some people are very, very low. For example, sociopaths have very few of these. And that's why they can see somebody suffering and not feel moved in the least to help. In fact, they can find it enjoyable. And then you have empaths who are so moved by everyone's feelings that they actually lose themselves. And so empathy training is not just to augment empathy for everybody. It's also to teach people how to set boundaries, like how to say something caring and kind, but also know when to end a session or to say, you know, we've answered the most pressing questions today. And if we want to get to the three other things on your list, let's schedule another appointment because they deserve all the time that they need and we can't fit them in today. So that's not the most welcome news, but it's at least empathetic that you're letting someone know you don't have the time for something in a way that says, but we can do it later, instead of we're out of time. I just don't have time for this. And so it's augmenting and changing these kinds of responses that make people feel cared about and respected, even when we have to set boundaries.
So this may be obvious, Helen, but I think we still scratch our heads on this. And I think to some extent, the question that you said prompted all of this is, hey, it's too bad we can't teach this, almost comes back to me. I feel, especially when we're thinking about doctors and nurses, you know, that who are choosing to go into this field, we think presumably because they really care and they care about people and they care about helping, that they would be so-called naturally empathetic. Is that not really the case, that they also want a spectrum and they just need to be taught this? And the related question I guess I have to that, because I presume your answer to that will be yes. The related question I have is, do doctors and nurses receive this idea that they need to get training? Do they receive that openly, or are they sometimes offended that, hey, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, you know, I've already been doing this for so many years, I'm already empathetic, you know, why do you think I need to have more empathy training?
Right. So your first question, don't people naturally come to healthcare with these qualities? And I listened to your podcast with Quint Studer, who said the first day in medical school, the first day they get the white coat, and their first day in the clinical service, their emotional banks are full. So I do believe that healthcare draws caring people. So I think we start with people very high in endowment. Unfortunately, because of lots of explicit training about don't care too much, don't get too attached, like stick to the facts. Some of that training has really impacted, especially older clinicians who were taught like detached concern. And it's gotten kind of beaten out of people. Also in medical schools where care and compassion are not emphasized in their curricula, it can get beaten out because what they really learn is, I need to learn the symptoms of congestive heart failure. I need to learn how to treat pneumonia. And so all this cognitive load can sometimes push the other soft skills aside. So we really need, at the medical school and pre-medical school level, an emphasis that you're going to be a more successful physician if you know how to relate to people in a caring way. And your second question, Apurv, is, do people feel insulted if an institution comes in with empathy training? I would say we did hear that more before the pandemic. Like, what do you mean? I'm empathetic. I'm compassionate. And sometimes the people who profess to be probably were like more low on the scale because they didn't really realize how many skills they could really learn to make them even come across even better. But because the burnout epidemic is so well known and so talked about, most people will actually say, yeah, I just don't feel as empathetic or compassionate as I used to, and it bothers me. We have heard from some nurses recently, they were so thrilled that their leadership brought empathetics in, because they say it feels really good to know that this whole organization still cares about these values. So people want to know that this is something important, in addition to, you know, how many people can you see in an afternoon and how quickly can you work this up? those are not the messages that are bringing out the love of the profession. Those are making people feel like they're cogs in a wheel. And so these other skills help connect them to purpose.
It's so remarkable how people who have gotten into this field because they are caring and want to do the right thing for society at large go through these institutions, which are also good, caring, good intention places. But yet somehow that still their structure takes that out of them. And then whenever you go back and say, well, we can put this back, they seem to fill that void again, which as backward as it seems, I think actually should give us hope that their reception, their positive reception to this could filter back into the institutions. And as you said, this can be institutionalized. So it's a fascinating dynamic that I think is so particularly fascinating as a psychiatrist, because you have done medical school, but you also are seeing these people with the mental health issues. And so it's a unique dynamic that I think most doctors don't, because you're still serving patients. You're still in a place where you can suffer burnout, especially when you're dealing with burnout of other people, but you also went through the pandemic and you also went through this medical training. So it's so fabulous to hear the work that you're doing and how it is changing people. And you said that when you went through this, you did at the Sutter Healthcare in California, you said they did the program in over 4 years. They had a 17 times retention rate for a value of $18 million in savings by doing the program. So how do you take an organization and institutionalize empathy and compassion?
So thanks for asking about that, because when you were saying, you know, how do you get leaders to pay attention to this? So most healthcare executives are in a really tough position. And as we learned from Quint, many of them are new and haven't even been in their positions that long. So they have an enormous responsibility to take a post-pandemic healthcare situation and financial situation and turn it around. So obviously they are going to ask, what's this going to cost us and what's the benefit? And so because one of the Sutter Health sites started with us in 2019 before the pandemic and stuck with us, they've been able to measure the impact on patient experience, on overall retention and burnout. The burnout scores got better. There was greater resilience. There were higher marks or grades for not just clinicians, but also the non-clinical staff. And then when they looked between 2019 and 2023 and compared non-trained versus empathetics trained, they saw this difference of 8.5 quitting who were not trained and 0.5% with the empathetics trained, which has really gotten their attention now. Because if you calculate, it's at a conservative $1 million to replace one position, that turned out to be like an $18 million savings. So I think healthcare leaders need to hear the good news that these empathy, compassion, sense of belonging, putting gratitude, all these soft skills are really coming out to give you hard outcomes. And, you know, there's nothing more disruptive than having people quit. All their institutional knowledge goes out the window, all the relationships that they had, it leaves a wake of problems and disaffection. So retaining staff and reigniting their passion for the work. I mean, Steve Treziak talked about the ROI is there. Like everything gets better when you invest, and the investment compared to the reward is minimal.
I am blown away by that, because I work, you know, with some of these institutions, and they're all struggling in this area and looking for impact in this way. And the kind of impact that you describe is just dramatic, especially during COVID, which is when everybody else started to experience the quite the opposite. So, you know, if you were doing this at any other time, you may have seen perhaps an even greater impact in the program. And I guess for my final question, it's, I guess, ironic that we're we're leaving it for the end, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about what is the program itself? What do you do? How do you train people? What is it that they learn that makes them more empathetic? And what kind of a time requirement does that take for an average physician or nurse to go through?
So we ground the training in science. So it's not like shake hands and be nice. And we really show the difference between being nice, which kind of means gratifying every request, which of course nobody can do, and then they feel bad, to like learning how to find out exactly what matters the most to the person and how to address those needs in a very kind and caring way. And to use your own body as an instrument for calibration. Like if you're feeling a little put off or annoyed by the way a patient is talking or a colleague, you have to think, maybe I'm picking up with their annoyance. Like if we just focus on ourselves, that's not empathy. When we realize that any kind of turbulence in a relationship probably reflects something going on between us or something that the person's brought in that maybe we should attend to, right? Maybe somebody's worried about something else and you're taking it as if they're upset with you. So we help distinguish whose feelings belong to whom, and how we self-manage. So a lot of it is about self-management. And a lot of it is about enhancing perception through emotion detection. And we have some software that that helps people really learn emotional accuracy. Doctors, before they're trained, were not that good at distinguishing between sadness, disgust, anger, or contempt. And you can imagine that the responses, if you mix those emotions up, could be way off. And that's what lingers, because people remember that you didn't address their emotion, even if you addressed their medical problem.
That is remarkable. disgust and sadness are very different things. So thank God you're there to help these people figure that out.
But imagine if you're got your, you know, your eyes on a computer and somebody's just made a face and you missed it. So we teach a lot about how to toggle between the technology and the clinical encounter. The online training, the basic training, is just 3 hours of spaced education. It's about once a month, 1 hour a month. And then we fit in a workshop where we train people at the organization how to conduct the classroom training. And we begin with self-empathy. So we don't go in there saying, you need to be more empathetic, you need to show more. We say, we know everyone's hurting right now. And even though this is not an individual problem, when an institution embraces this and endorses it and supports it, it comes across as an institutional remediation or an institutional caring act, rather than pointing your finger like, you need to go, you need to go. It's like, we all need to do this. And at our Sutter Health partners, the leaders took the training first. So they said, if we're going to implement this, we want to experience it. So I guess my biggest message is, leaders get it if they open themselves up to feeling, what is this like to learn these skills? And it makes them much better leaders, more compassionate leaders.
It's incredible work that you're doing. We appreciate your time and being here and sharing all of this with us. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you all for watching. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.